Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. On behalf of Cambridge Muslim College and its trustees, staff and students, it's a great pleasure for me to be able to welcome you to this, which is really our first major international conference, I think. For those of you who don't know, our college is now in its eighth full year of operation. We run, firstly, a one-year diploma program to train British imams in key leadership skills. We now have a four-year degree program in Islamic studies, and we host a number of full-time research fellows, including Dr. Asim Islam and Professor John Maybury, who are currently working on religion and science issues with funding from the Templeton Foundation. We are independent of Cambridge University, but have our own accreditation from the British Accreditation Council. For me, it's a source of particular pleasure that this first significant international event of ours should be on the subject of British Muslim history. Although the British Isles really are locked away at the further edge of the European landmass when seen from the perspective of the pre-modern Muslim geography, whether North African or Ottoman, our country has experienced forms of engagement with the Islamic world from a very early period. Catherine Beckett has written on Islam as understood from the perspective of Anglo-Saxon England, offering a recent survey of the very beginnings of this historic engagement. We have the book by Graham Davis on perceptions of Islam and Muslims in Welsh literature, and we've had occasion to host Dr. Davis to speak about his book at the college. There have long been distinguished studies of Islam as seen through the lens of British travellers, writers, theologians, Orientalists and poets. One of the most distinguished historians in this area, the Crusades expert, Jonathan Riley Smith, died only 3 days ago here in Cambridge. Like others, he showed that physical distance from the heartlands of the Muslim world was not in practice an impediment, being compensated for by our status as a maritime and often warlike nation. None of that, however, is of primary concern to us in today's conference. The history of British experiences of the world of Islam will be important history, but we're not writing that history today. Instead, we focus our attention on the history of Muslims who have lived on our shores. It turns out that this is a no less fascinating, but historiographically far more challenging venture. To be Muslim in Britain before the 19th century was to inhabit a risky and invidious position. One might perhaps enjoy diplomatic protection, as with, say, an Ottoman effendi accredited as a diplomat to the court of St. James. One might perhaps manage as a Moroccan silver trader in Manchester in the 18th century. But such individuals were necessarily birds of passage. Their origins and place of return lay in Oriental lands. The story of those who in some way pitched their tent here, necessarily fascinating, is that of individuals who are living a clash of civilizations in a way which was always discomforting and sometimes carried deadly risks. The titanic struggle of Europe itself, which for Pirenne and his school was also the creation and the definition of Europe, was against the Saracen Antiportas. Islam was the dark other of the Canción del Mio Cid, of the Battle of Kulikovo Field, of the Lusiads. It was Europe's dreaded nemesis and frustratingly successful other. Those who were that other's creed who sought to live here faced a truly difficult task. English literature, it's true, has no exact equivalent to the founding moments of national mythos which cast the people as heroes in an unequal fight against the Saracen or Hagarene invader. Spanish literature begins, we may say, with the Cave of Don Pelayo. French literature starts with the Chanson de Roland. The literatures of Britain, precisely because of our geographical location, trace their genesis to Arthurian legend, to Caedmon, to Beowulf. For us, in our own dark ages, the formative and defining other was usually the Norseman, the Dane, and not the Saracen. What Blake called the matter of England did not emerge from the refiner's fire of a crusade. Still, while the national imaginary lacks that sense of a genesis in tension with Islam, religious laws of an effectively totalitarian kind militated against the replication in Western Christendom of the kind of multicultural society which was normative in the Muslim world, whether in Al-Andalus or the Levant. late antique traditions of cosmopolitanism and ease of movement and intermarriage were maintained in the Islamic world and much less so in Christian lands. A Muslim in England, before the Enlightenment and the later laws of emancipation, was not Ahl al-Kitab or Ahl al-Dhimma in the eyes of the British Crown and Church. There was no such meliorative category of toleration. Jews existed according to various degrees of exclusion and disadvantage, being a people at least known in biblical record. But the Saracen was a deeper stranger. Islam, the second Semitism, did not carry the vitriolic stigma of deicide, but unlike the Jew, the Muslim recalled a neighboring military threat. He was still the object of almost universal condemnation and fear. So the project of a historiography of British Islam, when it seeks to reach far back in time, finds itself thwarted not only by the thin demography of Islam in pre-modern Britain that constitutionally could not acknowledge its stable presence, but also by the fact that Islam's sheer illegality made the creation of records, diaries, and other writings by early British Muslim residents all but impossible. Moreover, those British Muslims who fled our shores, whether as traders, corsairs, or simple adventurers, and who joined the not inconsiderable ranks of the renegados, were overwhelmingly unlettered men, simple mariners, soldiers of fortune, or slaves of various categories and provenances. Their names appear with some frequency in the Inquisition archives, as Bartolomé bin Nassar has shown in his book Les Chrétiens d'Allah. Yet they were overwhelmingly simple folk, incapable of writing their experiences down. One is almost reminded of the feminist complaint that half of history is missing because women did not or were not permitted to write. One bitterly regrets the silence. How many astounding adventures will never be told? One knows the picaresque adventures of, say, Samson Rowley or John Ward, but there must have been so many others, whether they remained in the Darul Islam or returned to our shores to retain, in some cases, their Islamic confession. But this remains, in substance, an empty page. Still, the true historian will only be incentivized by this void. We long to fill it. What we have and what we know turns out to be remarkable, not only because some unusual individuals and stories can be identified, but because their presence as witnesses to the Ishmaelite God in the heart of Christian Europe tells us so much about that Europe. If Islam is historically often constructed as Europe's significant other, its titanic rival, its inversion and mirror image, then British Muslim history must emerge as something far more than a simple marginal byway of odd traders, pirates, and romantic wanderers. Instead, the story of the Saracen within furnishes a remarkable illumination of how Britain has seen itself. The story finally continues. This is a history which is still being written. And today, too, we learn so much about the nation, its identity, its anxieties, ideals, and paranoias by examining its attitude to Muslims in its domains. Islam inhabits our present in complex and endlessly diversifying ways. Today, I'm sure that by looking at the British Muslim past, we will learn much about the narratives of our island in ways which are likely to prove of direct interest and relevance to the conversations we're now hearing about the role of Islam in Britain today.